Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 31 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful, amazing, magnanimous host, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing all right, Weird. Well, last week was pretty rough. I'm not going to get into that. It was rough. This week is a lot better. Although, I will admit that I have a sense of dread for the upcoming election. Because, well, I get the feeling that no matter who wins, we as Americans are going to lose.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. So, yeah, we're recording this on the Monday before Election Day. So, my daughter is super excited. I'm like, you want to go to the polls with me tomorrow? Yeah! Is that so? I don't follow the sports ball. As a matter of fact, for Father's Day at school, they did asked the child questions about their dad, and wrote it all down on a little thing. And one of them is, "What is your daddy's favorite sports team?" And she said, "None, because daddy doesn't like sports." And it's overall true, but to be fair. You know, my father was up last night watching the Patriots late into the evening, I guess. I don't know. I have no idea what the hell the Patriots were up to. I know they won because he told me. But other than that, don't know. I know that that's football, and that's the one where it's the oblong-shaped one that you don't really kick. And, so the exact thing that dad's doing, watching all that, is me. I'm gonna be like when I get up in the morning, I'm gonna be, you know, after the election. It used to be I would stay up until like 1 o'clock in the morning, just drinking heavily and watching, you know, hitting refresh on the news channels of watching the various poll numbers come in. And I've realized it's just crap, because it's just one of those like inconclusive called, and it's just very anticlimactic. So instead I just like, all right, cool. Stay up for a little bit, maybe watch a little bit of exit stuff, but realize it's all crap, and then just go to bed. And this first thing in the morning, usually first thing in the morning, mean like I get up to go take a leak at 3 a.m. and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go turn on the computer and have a real quick look and see what went down. I'll look at the Massachusetts turnout and see how that went first. Cause you know, that's my life. And then I'm going to look at all of your other elections, because guess what? That's the games. You know, the Ted Cruz versus Beto O'Rourke. Yes, that has implications for the entire nation, but really that's Texas's battle too. I don't care. I'm watching it with bated breath.
Yeah. So how are things looking in the race between Mara Healey and her challenger?
I have not heard much of, that's one of those ones that I haven't heard much of anything. As a general rule, it's not like the attorney general It's not that it's not a heavily contested race, but it is a race that is
it's not sexy, so it doesn't get the
publicity. It's not sexy. So I have seen nothing about that, have not seen any yard signs whatsoever. And like, that was actually the big thing that got me. The old saying goes, yard signs don't vote. That is absolutely true. But you could definitely get a flavor of things going on. I would say it doesn't look good for our governor, Charlie Baker, because you'll see lots of yard signs with various Republican candidates on it. And Charlie Baker, our governor, conspicuously absent. But supposedly he's doing quite well in the polling, though I fully plan on voting against him, because, hey man, there's got a guy that's left gun owners in Massachusetts hung out to dry versus a guy that's vaguely hostile against gun owners. But, well, he hasn't done anything directly against us. And on top of that, we went from Mitt Romney, who did a whole bunch of stuff to increase the onerous gun laws against lawful gun owners before he went off to lose the presidential campaign. And then we get Deval Patrick, who is essentially a 5'4" Barack Obama. Though he sounds more like, what was that freak show that was the mayor of Chicago that's currently in prison?
Blagojevich?
Yes. I was like, really crazy last name. Yeah, Rod Blagojevich. Deval Patrick, even though he's African-American, when Blagojevich was like fighting for his political life and trying not to go to prison. So I was hearing him on the news all the time. And I don't have TV. I listen to radio almost exclusively. So I sometimes don't even know what these people look like, but I know their voice by heart. And when Blagojevich would come on, I could not tell if that was our governor or if that was the mayor of Chicago. Just almost identical sounding voices. So he doesn't sound like Barack Obama, but the yes, we can, and together we can, and all that. Those are Deval Patrick stuff that he gave to Barack Obama when he started running. So yeah. Wow. Openly hostile to gun owners, got absolutely nothing done on the gun stuff. So honestly speaking, I kind of would take an anti-gun Democrat over a pro-gun Massachusetts Republican at this point, because it seems like there's a very consistent thing that goes when there's pro-gun Republicans.
So really the only election I'm truly paying attention to here in Florida is the governor's race, because, well, it's between a Republican and a Democrat, and the Democrat, Gillum, really does remind me of Obama in all the worst ways. And when, well, okay, I am afraid he's going to win. The polls are certainly showing that he's in the lead, although I don't need to tell you that, what, in even the last days of the 2016 election, I think it was forecast that Hillary Clinton had like a 98% whatever chance to win. So I'm hoping that a lot of the Republican voters were keeping quiet, but it truly looks like the Republican candidate Ron DeSantis really didn't care. I mean, he kind of wants to win, but he doesn't seem to really want it, because I don't exactly know when the election ads kicked off, but I kept seeing ads for Gillum blasting his opponent, and it took me forever to see ads for DeSantis at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, do you not want to win? I mean, because are you even trying? Because your opponent is eating your lunch. He's got all this publicity. Now, some very interesting and scandalous stuff has come up in about the last couple weeks, and Gillum has not made friends with the police in the state, because he has said, and okay, I don't know, I didn't hear him say this, I could be repeating someone else's soundbite, but I believe he said something like, in his opinion, police shouldn't ever draw their service weapon or a taser or things like that. And that apparently irritated most police officers. And so he's making all the typical anti-gun noises about how he'll fight the NRA and he'll ban AR-15s and things like that, and I personally think he's corrupt. But
if he's not corrupt, he's probably going to work real hard to become so. Because honestly speaking, you know, being at the head of a corruption racket—that's a pretty cushy deal.
Yeah. So really, I'm paying most attention to that race, and then if he wins, well, we'll see what happens. Because there's always the chance he'll be deadlocked. But here's the thing about Florida, and I can't really explain why it is. It just is. Florida is known as the Gunshine State. I don't think we're going to be known that for much longer, because, well, there's something strange that happens when you're a Republican in Miami, and that is you become anti-gun. And I don't really know why that is. Maybe because Miami has a crime problem and a gang problem, and they use drugs, and so in order to appeal to their constituents, they have to be anti-gun. But every time a good gun law has come up in the Florida legislature, it's almost always killed or tabled by a Miami Republican. So, that's my concern, that if this guy is anti-gun, that even if we have a Republican legislature to fight him, that they might still pass this. So that's my personal worry. And on a completely unrelated note, I think I'm going to have to schedule a fishing trip.
Nice.
Or something on a boat, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I understand that. Yeah, just go see the sights of Okeechobee. Maybe take an airboat through the Everglades.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm not that familiar with Florida politics going back. When was the last time you had a Democrat governor?
Not long ago.
Well, wait, was that weird orange thing? Was that a Democrat?
Weird orange thing.
Yeah, you had a Trumpish colored man as a governor that he kind of freaked me out.
Are you talking about Lawton Chiles or are you talking about Charlie Crist?
I think I'm talking about Crist.
Well, Crist had white hair, and I don't really know where you got orange, although he is kind of tanned in the face, so maybe that's where you were getting.
Yeah.
Crist is a flip-flopper.
Gotcha.
Yeah, he began his political career as a Republican, and I think at one point he changed parties to run again or something like that. I don't remember. You called me on something I was not prepared for.
Oh, no worries. I just couldn't remember what party he was.
Well, yes. Okay.
I just knew he was no friend to gun owners or
Floridians. No, not at all. Okay, yeah. So he began his career as a Republican. He became a Democrat in 2012. And then he ran for governor in 2014. And I think what happened was he joined the Democrat Party in order to get in on the Obama goodwill and trying to get elected there. And he lost to Rick Scott, who is also not really a friend of gun owners. Mm. But he served his two terms, and we're hopefully going to kick him up to the Senate where he can be a little fish in a big pond. Because really, the choices right now, he's running against Bill Nelson, and Bill Nelson is a career politician. He's been in the House since like the 70s, I think, or maybe, yeah, well, I don't know if it was House or Senate or whatever, but yeah, he's been in Washington for a real long time, and he doesn't really seem to do anything. He's just sort of there, and he is very stridently anti-gun. And so he basically cancels out anything pro-gun that our other Senator Marco Rubio votes for. So as much as I dislike rewarding Scott for passing that very strong gun control measure and stabbing us all in the back, getting rid of Nelson is a lot more important. And, you know, he's not going to be a big deal for quite a while. He will take his marching orders. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully that will be better than basically Florida canceling itself out.
Yeah. Well, I was just asking on the, like I mentioned with Massachusetts, is that Mitt Romney, pro-gun Republican Mitt Romney. And, you know, and but before that, like our wonderful Massachusetts assault weapons ban, which is the whole reason why you and I are very curious on what's going to happen with Mara Healey come this election. That was signed into law by Bill Weld, libertarian Bill Weld, quote, all scare quotes to my fingers are breaking scare quoting here. it seems that when there is an anti-gun Democrat who's openly against it, it seems all of a sudden the people that are come see, come saw on gun control suddenly get a little bit of pep in their step. So I don't know if that happens in Florida or not.
Yeah. I think that's true pretty much everywhere. And there seems to be some sort of gun owner's paradox. And we experienced that with the Trump slump, in that when you have a pro-gun or at least ostensibly pro-gun president in office, your rights go up, or at least they don't decline, but people aren't that hot to own guns. It's only when you have an anti-gun president in office that people are going, oh my God, I gotta get me some more guns before they get made illegal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know how to address that, but isn't it weird how we only really support our industry when it's the bad times and not the good times?
Well, I think there's also that, I mean, I think we're both like Second Amendment absolutists, is that, you know, I should be able to walk down to the local convenience store and, you know, buy a pack of cigarettes, a fifth of vodka, and, you know, an M16 full auto. You know, it's just one of those, like, why not? If I've got the cash, all this hemming and hawing that we do, it's one of those, it doesn't really accomplish all that much. But yet when it comes to the, oh, maybe we should relax this restriction and say that when I go to the polling place tomorrow, I can maybe carry my gun because it's a school, but I'm not going to school and it's, I'm not going to shoot any kids. I've got a legal carry permit. I can walk past the school. Ugh. You know, when somebody said do that, oh no, it's a great social experiment. No, it's not. It's not.
All right. So to answer your question that you asked me earlier, Florida has not had an officially Democrat governor since 99.
Okay. Who was that?
That was Buddy McKay. And then we had Jeb Bush. And then we had Charlie Crist, who was Republican for one term and then an independent for his second term. And then he switched to Democrat to try and get elected again or something. I think he was trying to pull a, what's his name? What was it, a Bloomberg? Or
yeah,
was it
a... Yeah, Bloomberg. Bloomberg was a lifelong Democrat. And then when he was running for governor, he switched his party affiliation to Republican so that he could run a Republican primary against a New York City Republican, which
yeah,
super duper easy, super duper cheap, and save his money for the general election where he would be running against the Democrat as opposed to blowing all his capital and probably taking a whole bunch of damage in debates and things like that with a heavily contested Democrat seat against someone who's quote unquote on his own side. Instead, yeah, just go up against that other person. And so it was completely a tactical move. He did that. Yeah, then he switched to independent because, yeah, he was totally independent. And then after all his political career was over, he has since switched back to being a Democrat and making some sort of big fanfare as if there was some sort of life choice of the no, it's, I've got nothing to gain from pretending to be a Republican.
So just to sort of cap this off with a little bit of trivia that I think is interesting. The very first governor of Florida, I don't mean elected, but I mean in that general term of someone who governs.
Are we talking about like back when this was owned by Spain?
No, we are talking about when America acquired it. But the federal military commissioner of Florida in 1821 was Andy By God Jackson.
Oh, about as Democrat as you could get.
Yeah, but he's still cool.
Super duper cool. Actually, we had a history class, but history teacher, I think he was just killing time, just being a history geek and going, hey, you know what? I could just be a history geek with these kids and get them excited about history. And like I said, it was one of the better history lessons. And we literally did the, all right, which U.S. president would be the most badass? Who could win in a fight, in a battle royale against other presidents? Who was the one that died of pneumonia like 3 days after he got inaugurated?
Wasn't that Harrison?
Yes. Yeah. So like Harrison was out from the start because like, yeah, you just died of pneumonia for giving your speech. You're not going to last in the ring. And Lincoln was in for a little bit, but there was talks about, I think, did people say that he had Graves' disease, or there was talk that he was a very, very sick guy. And he was wearing like braces and things like that when he was killed. And so the Lincoln's like, all right, he's a big dude, strapping guy, but yeah, probably not that tough. And going through and fast forward through the final round was Andy Jackson versus Teddy Roosevelt.
Ooh.
And that would have been a fight to watch because those guys were both scrappy.
Yeah, I'm actually envisioning a bare-chested boxing match, you know, in the old-fashioned style where they had their hands up like the Irish pugilists.
Yes.
Yes. I could definitely see that.
The big thing that got it was the Teddy Roosevelt getting shot in the middle of a speech. And and then when his assailant was captured, said, well, I've still got my speech. Let me do my speech. It'll be slightly briefer because A, there's a bullet hole through the notes, and B, there's a bullet in my lung. And then Andy Jackson took sword strikes, was well known for winning arguments by beating people with his cane. So yeah, that was, man, those are the good old days of politics. I would really like to see this go through.
So I actually had a joke back in the day, and not many people got it. So you remember when Karl Rove accidentally shot, I think, his lawyer while on a hunting trip?
Oh, no, that was Dick Cheney.
Oh, Dick Cheney. I'm sorry. My bad. I'm horrible with names, but okay. And people.
Karl Rove might have been there.
Okay. So anytime people would talk about it and mention about how Dick Cheney was just a horrible human being, I, in my full geek mode, would say, man, for the good old days when vice presidents shot to kill.
Oh, good old Aaron Burr.
Thank you for getting it.
Yes. Solidly. Well, there's since been a musical.
Oh, that's true. I'd forgotten.
Last week, Oddball told us how to care for our various knives. But if your knife is always sharp, it means you aren't using it. So what do you do when your knife goes dull? Oddball gives us some tips on how to keep your blade sharp.
Sometimes a knife will not come as sharp as you would like. And if you actually use your knives, they will also see wear and lose their edge over time. This isn't a big deal, but you will want some special tools to get that edge back up to where it should be. It might be a bit counterintuitive, but you're more likely to cut yourself on a dull knife than a sharp knife. It takes more effort to cut something with a dull knife. This means that you're more likely to have the knife slip out of your hand, and the more it's going to jump after it cuts through whatever you're cutting through. Now, of course, you can always take your knife to a pro and have them sharpen it for you. There's usually at least one guy offering his services at your local gun show or farmer's market. Heck, I've seen the service offered at my local Bass Pro. If you have something that you're not real comfortable walking around with, or you know it's going to take a while, there's also a number of folks that you can send it in to sharpen. Also, many pocket knife brands will sharpen your knife for free or small price if you just send it back to them. Having a pro do it for you is a great option, especially if you're not comfortable doing it yourself or the edge is in bad shape and you need to completely reprofile it. They've got expensive equipment and have a lot more practice than you do. That said, minor sharpening jobs aren't difficult and don't require super expensive equipment. First off, I'm going to say those cheap little hand sharpeners that have a V-notch to run the knife through, don't bother. I keep one in my box of sharpening stuff, but only because it has a carbide notch that I've used on knives that needed desperate help. I've never had luck using one to put a proper edge on a knife, and the general consensus is that they're junk. You really want to spend a little bit extra to get a proper set of stones or a proper sharpening system. Sharpening stones are one of those things that you can spend a small amount of money on, or a lot. I've seen guys sharpen knives on a brick, and I've seen stones that cost $100 each. I'm not sure I'd recommend you going with either one of these solutions, especially as a beginner. I'm a fan of Smith's Tri-Hone system for a good budget sharpening stone system. It comes with three stones of different grit, and it's currently listed at about $25 for natural stones and $48 for the diamond stones on Amazon. The diamond stones are probably the better way to go, but the natural stones will work perfectly well for significantly less. To use these stones, start with the most coarse stone and simply run the edge down the stone. You'll want to try your best to align the pre-existing edge with the stone. Try as best as you can to maintain the knife's angle the entire way through. If the angle is too steep, you'll actually remove whatever edge there was already there. If it's too narrow, the stone won't actually reach the edge and you're not really sharpening it. As a beginner, I recommend only pressing the edge against the stone while dragging the knife in the direction of the spine of the blade. It might be a little bit slower, but it's more forgiving if the knife bounces and you let the angle change. Once you get more comfortable with using the stones, you can start dragging the knife in both directions if you want to. After you've done this a number of times on both sides of the blade, say 10 times each side for a quick touch-up or 20 or more for a duller blade, move on to the medium grit stone and repeat. After that, do the same with the fine grit stone. If you have more or less stones, just progress from the most coarse to the smoothest. Oh, if you're using a natural stone, you'll want to wet it either with oil or water. This is to stop the metal shavings from clogging up the stone, and you really can't get one of these stones too wet. I mentioned that you generally will want to match the angle the edge was already set at. You'll notice that different types of cutting tools will have their edges set at different angles. The general rule is that the narrower the angle, the sharper the edge, and the better it slices. The downside is that it also means that the edge is more fragile, and therefore more prone to chipping or having the edge actually roll over on you. Kitchen knives are typically set at the most narrow angle, with some Japanese-style knives coming with edges set at 10 or 15 degrees, although most kitchen knives are closer to 17 to 20 degrees. And if you have things like machetes or axes, that's on the other end of the spectrum, where it's not uncommon to see a 40-degree edge. For an EDC pocket knife, you should be somewhere in the middle. I personally like mine closer to the 20 degrees mark, but it's really up to you. If you can't feel where the edge is, it's pretty easy to get to where you should be. Put the edge on the stone with the spine of the knife pointing straight up. That's 90 degrees. Tilt it halfway and you've got 45 degrees. Half again and that's roughly 22 degrees and a decent spot for a knife edge. I realize that this is one of those things that's much easier with visuals, and I'll put a YouTube video in the show notes to help out. You'll notice that the gentleman in this particular video likes to push the knife edge towards the edge across the stone, but unfortunately that was really the best video I could find. I think I'm going to actually split this into two segments and stop here. If you'd like to read more of my stuff, I write at gunscarstech.com. And if you have any questions or suggestions for future segments, feel free to email me at oddball@gunscarstech or give me a shout out on the ACP Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
Now, I actually like the slot sharpeners that he poo-poos, mainly because I can tuck them into a bug-out or get-home bag for a fraction of the space that his stones take up. My favorite is the Lansky Quad Sharp, which I reviewed on the Gunblog Variety Cast last year. But short version, for $15, you can get a pocket sharpener that does 17, 20, 25, and 30 degrees, plus a ceramic strip for honing. Now, it's not perfect, but it's a great way to dress your blade while you're out in the field, because that is the worst place a knife can go dull.
Yeah, actually, I always used to keep one when I used to go out in the boats. Because number one, I'm not using the greatest knife on earth. I'm just using just some halfway decent carbon steel blade that will hold an edge fine, but it's going to be all like rusted and pitted and in bad shape because, yeah, salt water and fish blood. You just, and I'm cleaning it off with salt water. But yeah.
Carbon out on the sea. That's a bold choice, Cotton.
When it goes bad, I would throw it over the side and pull out another one. I think they were like $2. It was just,
damn.
Yeah, it was just there was so much disposable hardware that was just the, oh, that's done, over the side. We're gonna float test it. But yeah, no, I like them as well as a, yeah, just quick and dirty, slap that on there and just get it done. You know, you're busy doing something else. You're not going to take your time to, you know, count your strokes and make sure you're getting it everything very perfect. Is the, no, this blade is not sharp enough, I need it sharp now. Those are fine. Oh, you know, interesting thing was on the whole natural stone and wetting. I always wondered about wetting of stones because I almost exclusively use ceramic and diamond now. And yeah, I'll get them wet just to kind of lift the metal out of the pores or into the crevices of it. But overall, yeah, mostly I'm just doing it dry, and I don't like getting your stones super soaked because it makes a mess.
Every time there's a mass shooting, the anti-gun zealots are out in force, dancing in the blood of the dead to make an appeal to emotion because the facts can't support their position. Their talking points have practically become boilerplate, and Weird gives that boilerplate a good fisking.
This week's Audio Fisk is a bit of audio attached to a Bloomberg News article. The article was talking about a new study that showed, despite the political rhetoric, in fact, active shooter events, as defined by the FBI, were more likely to involve a handgun or shotgun than semi-auto rifles. I was interested in hearing the audio discussing this, only it didn't. Instead, I got this pile of anti-gun boilerplate.
Americans own more guns than anybody else on Earth. Firearms are involved in the deaths of more than 33,000 people in the U.S. annually.
Yes, we own more guns than anybody else, and that 30,000 number is correct. But of course, the bulk of those deaths are suicides. And as scary as this sounds, we are still one of the safest nations in the world. When trying to demonize the United States, the anti-gunners frequently compare us to high-income or developed nations, noting, of course, that they handpick out the nations like Russia, South Africa, or Mexico who meet those requirements, have extremely strict gun control laws, and a horrible violent crime problem. In the end, you can play games with the numbers all you want, but most places are more dangerous than the United States, and it's not because of their gun laws.
Every time another mass shooting occurs in the U.S., it sparks arguments over gun ownership rights.
Because the anti-gun position is horrendously unpopular. In this election cycle, the anti-gun groups have been creating ads that support their candidates but don't talk about their positions on guns, and candidates have been caught telling supporters they indeed support banning guns but won't discuss it until after the election. When you have to hide your agenda from the public, you are not in a good place politically. So really, the only time the anti-gunners feel safe flying their extremist flag is when blood is in the streets and emotions are running high. Thankfully, that really hasn't been working out for them as well as it has in the past.
Here's the situation. In 2017, pro-gun advocates got a boost when Republicans gained control of the White House and both chambers of Congress.
Here's a little nonpartisan PSA for all of you. The Republicans, the party that supports the Second Amendment, took control of the legislature as well as the executive branch. And what do we have to show for it? What sweeping gun reforms have there been? About the same as when President Obama had his supermajority of anti-gun Democrats. Just because the party byline says something about the Second Amendment or gun control doesn't mean they'll put that agenda item over bickering over foolish crap.
A month later, congressional Republicans rolled back a rule adopted by President Barack Obama in 2016 that was aimed at preventing people with serious mental health problems from buying guns.
The yeas are
bullshit. No, the Obama executive order declared that anybody who had a designated payee for their Social Security check obviously must be mentally ill and made them prohibited persons. It was a horrible executive order, and anybody who isn't glad that it's gone isn't a nice person.
Back in 2013, Congress defeated a bill to expand background checks. This was just months after a mass shooting took place at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut,
where the shooter murdered his own mother to steal her guns and illegally bring them to the school. This is the whole reason why the anti-gunners are ghouls. They have their boilerplate legislation, but it can't see the light of day under normal circumstances. No, it needs an emotional news story to be unveiled. And they don't care a whit if it has any relation to the event they're attaching it to.
In the U.S., 25 children die from bullet wounds each week.
And about 40% of these homicides are suicide, and the bulk of the remainder are teen children involved in gang activity. Again, this isn't a gun problem.
Gun rules are largely determined by states. Since 2013, Democrat-led states like California and Oregon have expanded gun restrictions, though a majority of states have weakened restrictions, and many now permit guns in more places, like schools, restaurants, churches, and public buildings.
So let's start with the big point. When states relax gun restrictions, there has been no increase in violent crime. None. And in some cases, crime has gone down. Further, there have been zero school shootings in schools that allow campus carry or staff to be armed. So really, state restrictions on guns do nothing for public safety, but they do limit individual freedom.
Also, all 50 states allow people to carry weapons that are concealed from public view.
And unless they were the few states that had restrictions before the 1990s, those states are shall issue. And as I mentioned above, have not seen an increase in crime.
And many states have expanded rights to use guns in self-defense.
This is the Stand Your Ground law that simply is a clarification that says you don't need to prove you are unable to retreat from a location you are lawfully able to be in before you use deadly force. And of course, you can only use deadly force when you are in imminent danger of severe bodily harm. Think about it. If I'm concerned that you might kill me right now, why should I be looking for avenues of escape when I have the means to stop you right now?
Congress let a ban on assault weapons expire in 2004. Violent crime in America has fallen significantly. And fatal and non-fatal shootings have also declined. Meanwhile, gun control advocates say limiting weapons will drive down gun-related crimes.
Again, all the facts I've stated above. Meanwhile, the antis claim that their agenda will do the exact opposite of reality. Seriously, this is the definition of insanity.
And they point to Australia, where strict gun ownership laws were enacted after a historic massacre in 1996. Since then, there have been zero mass shootings, and firearms-related death rates have plummeted.
Except for the mass shootings that have happened in Australia. Also, let's just ignore the arsons and mass stabbings that have happened, as only gun deaths are relevant to these ghouls. They mention the violent crime numbers going down, but Australian gun ownership rates are going up. Again, it isn't the guns here. But boy, they will contort the truth to push their agenda. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Ah, the good old Australian model and how it's failed to prevent mass shootings like the Monash University killings, where the murderer killed two people and injured five others. I talked about that back in September, I think.
Yep. It's kind of funny. It was just one of those like, oh man, there's not really any direction to this. It's just a whole bunch of crap. But it's kind of the best kind of thing to Fisk because these are all like super common anti-gun arguments. So again, those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them. Listen to it because this is the type of stuff when you're sitting around the water cooler and somebody says, you know, this common sense gun control solution is a kind of a good idea. And instead of having your temper get hot and red of the, oh man, this is one of those jerks who believes this crap. Instead, you've just got some rebuttals. You've got some ideas. You've got some angles to go after them to maybe get them to rethink and going, oh, maybe it's not a good idea. Or you can just get the idea of, oh, this is just a crazy gun banner person. I should just disengage as much as I can.
Now, I think you should take a lot of these point by point rebuttals and put them in a blog post on a card.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe make a flow chart so that people can actually use them, because it's very hard for me to go and look things up on a podcast.
That's true.
That is the beauty of a blog post. If it's written down, you can search for it.
Yeah.
And you make some really good points. And there have been times when I've been debating someone and I'm going, damn, I wish Weird was here. He'd tell me what to say next.
Yeah, I mean, there's a search feature on my blog, and there's a reason why I got picked to do the audio Fisks when Sean started up the Gun Blog Variety Cast. It was, yeah, because, yeah, I've been doing that for ages, take people's blog posts. It's just I did it with text instead of audio or video.
Yeah, but still, I think there would be a benefit for, I don't know, a couple of laminated 3x5 cards with some of your, you know, your arguments on there. Well, if they bring up this, then you counter with that.
That's probably a good idea. I'll have to think about putting that together.
You know, if they bring up Kellerman, you say,
mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is a very good point.
There's an old Jewish saying that goes, man plans and God laughs. This means you can make all the plans you want, but reality has a nasty way of interfering with them. David's plans for this week's segment changed after the Tree of Life Synagogue shooting happened in Pittsburgh.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. I had a light-hearted segment planned for this week, however, I've preempted it due to recent events. What happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh was horrific. It's being reported as the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in the United States. While there have been several attacks recently that occurred at places of worship, this is, as far as I know, the only one of those that specifically targeted the worshippers based on their religious affiliation. Being Jewish myself, and with this attack following shortly after the High Holy Days, it's affected me more than any other recent violent event. It's also led me to reflect on the internal conflicts regarding firearms within Jewish culture in America. Growing up Jewish in New York City was interesting. I lived among the largest Jewish population outside of Tel Aviv. Even though I never felt I belonged in New York City, I knew that these were my people and I shared a common culture and history, a culture and history that generated a certain amount of pride. One winter when I was a teenager, my mother and I took a trip to Ellis Island, around 100 years after my ancestors passed through that same place. While there, my mother took a picture of me in my long wool coat, holding an umbrella, and sitting on one of the benches. In this picture, I could almost pass for one of the immigrants of a bygone age. By the way, this was before the major renovation in the 1980s. My family donated to the renovation fund, and two of our ancestors' names are engraved on a memorial brick along the seawall. My mother and I went back later, after the renovation was finished, and saw the amazing improvements that had been made to restore the site and enhance the educational and historical elements for tourists. One of the interesting things about being pro-Second Amendment and Jewish is the cognitive dissonance that this causes in some people, my own family among them. There's also an interesting dividing line in American Jewish outlook on firearms ownership based generally around the Second World War. Jews who came to the United States prior to the war are often referred to as having a shtetl worldview. A shtetl is the name for small Jewish towns or villages in Eastern Europe. The shtetl outlook is generally that the government will take care of you. Even though historically in Eastern Europe, the government taking care of you was closer to the mob version of that phrase than the loving family meaning. These Jews preferred to keep guns in the hands of the government in order to keep them out of the hands of roving bands of Cossacks who would raid these settlements. Overall, this didn't work out well for them. Jews who emigrated to the United States after World War II had a different outlook. They had seen firsthand what a powerful, determined government could do to a despised or inconvenient minority. Many post-war Jewish immigrants tended to look on firearms ownership as not only a good thing, but essential for the survival of the Jewish people. These are not absolutes. There were pre-war Jews who were pro-Second Amendment and post-war Jews who are anti, of course. For example, during Israel's fight for independence in the 1940s, many American Jews risked jail or exile to either fight for Israel directly or help the Israeli military get the supplies, including firearms, that they so desperately needed. Or my case as another example. My family arrived in America in the 1880s from Eastern Europe, after the start of the Russian pogroms against the Jews living beyond the pale of society, but well before the formation of the Soviet Union or the rise of Nazi Germany. The vast majority of my family is anti-gun. Some are extremely anti-gun, and view guns and gun owners with discomfort and confusion. For me, my grasp of history led me to the position that there has never been a time in history that giving the government a monopoly on force has worked out well for the Jewish people. After all, without the ability and willingness to apply defensive force, never again is just a catchy slogan. The general American view of the Jewish community in this country is that of the anti-gun urban liberal. While there is a great deal of truth to this, it's not complete. There are many Jews in this country, myself among them, who will not only fight to protect our people, our tribe if you will, but will also train any others who would do the same. I was extremely touched when Aaron posted on the Operation Blazing Sword Facebook page that our instructors were willing to teach anyone, not just members of the LGBT community, but anyone. In this post, she specifically mentioned Jews who might want to learn to defend themselves with a firearm. As with the LGBT community, it will be a challenge to reach the most at-risk members of the Jewish community with this message. Many Jews, even politically conservative Jews, feel that weapons are inappropriate in synagogue. Some very religious Jews even cover their knives at the dinner table during certain holiday meals. I am not one of those Jews. When I go to synagogue, I hope that the hate and violence of the world stays outside. I know some see us as a soft target. However, I intend to be prepared if a threat barges in offering violence to me and mine to stop that threat. While some states do prohibit the carrying of firearms in places of worship, as far as I could find, there is nothing in Pennsylvania law that would prevent a member of a synagogue from carrying a concealed firearm. The closest thing I could find is a restriction on carrying in elementary and secondary schools, which I don't think pertains to places of private religious education. This may have been an unspoken social agreement, or even the request of the rabbi. I've tried several times to put together some commentary about those in the media or politics who are trying to use this attack to push gun control, some of them being Jewish themselves. Mostly what I came up with were long strings of profanity. Maybe I'll be able to come up with something more coherent and rational later, after my emotions have eased. Which, by the way, is an excellent reason that legislation should not be pushed through when emotions are high, but instead later, after calm and rational deliberation and debate. If such a thing is possible in this country anymore. The incident that generated the topic for this segment has been, as I mentioned, referred to as the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in the United States. Personally, I think that title may belong to an incident in 1939 when the United States government turned away the MS St. Louis, a ship loaded with over 900 Jewish refugees attempting to escape the charnel house that Europe was becoming. The result of that ship being turned away led to 254 of the 937 passengers being killed in the Holocaust. I know the ship never actually reached the United States, but it was not our finest moment as a country. There were 11 fatal victims of the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. Considering that there were between 60 and 100 people in the synagogue at that time, the fact that the body count was so low is something of a miracle. 11 defenseless people were murdered simply because they were Jewish. That and being in the wrong place at the wrong time. The murderer apparently called out that he wanted all Jews to die both when he opened fire on the congregants and later when he was captured by the police. The rabbi of Tree of Life Synagogue, Jeffrey Myers, was asked by a CNN reporter whether he blamed anyone for the attack. He responded, "I don't really foist blame upon any person. Hate does not know religion, race, creed, political party. It's not a political issue in any way, shape, or form. Hate does not know any of these things. It exists in all people. Yes, there is the possibility of hate in all people, but there is also the possibility of good. A sentiment it would benefit us all to keep in mind." Now, in keeping with Jewish tradition, I will list the names of those who died in this attack. Joyce Feinberg, Rich Gottfried, Rose Malinger, Jerry Rabinowitz, Cecil Rosenthal, David Rosenthal, Bernice Simon, Sylvia Simon, Daniel Stein, Melvin Wax, Irving Younger. May their memories be a blessing. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Oh, boy. Got a little bit dusty in here. How about, I don't know about you, Aaron?
Yeah, well, this is one of those cases, I feel, where being emotional while reading the segment actually adds something to it.
Also, this is the first time, I have not been reading too much into it. It's one of those, these mass shootings, they're just brutal to dive into it. So unless there's something I'm specifically looking for, I don't even dive into it anymore. And I didn't realize how big the synagogue was. And the one thing that I did know was how long the shooter was unchallenged in this one. And I'm amazed that the body count was as low as it was. Like, that's impressive.
It really is. And that's one of those things where, on the one hand, you want to say it's a miracle, but that feels kind of weird and cheap and creepy because, well, if that's a miracle, then why didn't we have the greater miracle of the gunman not showing up at all?
Yeah, or something. Or getting hit by a bus as he was trying to cross the street.
Right. So while I agree it is amazing and wonderful that the body count was only so small, it just feels weird to call it a miracle.
Yeah, and it also goes against my standard philosophy, as I say, like, all right, if the balloon goes up for you and you're stuck in an area where there's lots of people and there's someone who's looking to commit mass murder and there's no you don't have a direct path to the exit, I always tell people, look, all right, congratulations, you're dead. Act accordingly, though. Like, all right, cool. You're probably going to be killed here. How do you want to go out? Do you want to, you know, hide and, you know, pull the Colin Goddard thing where Colin Goddard got under his desk and just laid still and the gunman came up to him in Virginia Tech and shot him two or three times, I think it was, and then moved on. And thankfully the gunman was incompetent and Colin Goddard lived. And that's not true for a whole bunch of other people who use that same tactic. Or could you be like the Holocaust survivor professor that David mentioned, who just said, "Yep, yeah, nope, I'm fighting. I'm going down fighting." And in some cases, like when Gabby Giffords was shot, the people just unarmed people just dove on the guy, and that stopped it. It's very, very risky. Not a situation where you're one of those, oh, this is going to work out perfectly fine. No, you could get shot. You could get injured. You could get killed. But you could get shot, injured, and killed when you're in this situation, period. So why not throw a Hail Mary at that point?
This actually reminds me of something I read while I was studying The Art of War. I don't remember if it was ever in The Art of War because I went back to try and find it and I couldn't find it again. It might have been in a footnote. It might have been related to another book. Listeners, if you know what this is, drop me a link because I would love to hear it. But what I remember was, the statement was, one man committed to his own death can defeat 10 or 20 men committed to life. The logic being is that if you say, I'm going to accomplish this and I don't care if I die in the process, and you are fighting people who really aren't committed to dying to accomplish things and just want to live, they will run away. And the link here is, if you are in that active shooter situation and you know that you are going to die, then that gives you a certain amount of freedom, and the person who is committed to dying can accomplish fantastic things. And while I'm not encouraging our listeners, of course, to kill themselves, I just thought it was a very interesting thought that once you accept that you have nothing else to lose, you can achieve greatness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another similar angle that I think it was one of Masayub's books where I read about it, but I can't remember. But it was talking about if someone actually takes a direct shot to the heart. So you fire your gun and it literally either cuts the aorta or just goes right through the atria, and the heart has two big holes in it. That person still has 30 seconds to a minute before they're unconscious and then dead. That's certainly a wound where it doesn't matter. You could shoot the person in the emergency ward of the hospital and they're not coming back from that. But they will have 30 seconds to a minute. I can't remember what the actual number was, but where they are still in full control of their body. And at that point in time, if you are committed, and I think the context I was reading on was talking about police officers, you might get killed in a firefight. If you get killed, keep fighting until you're dead. Like, keep fighting until it's all done. Like, don't
make your death meaningful.
Yeah. Yes. Don't give up because you know you're killed. And there's also certain angles on police officers getting shot and just falling down and it being like the vest caught it. It was a superficial wound. You were still in the fight, but I was shot. I might be dying. Just don't concern yourself with that. If there's a fight to be done and there's innocent people around, like, yeah, neutralize the threat. If you end up dying from it, you end up dying from it. Make your death meaningful. That's a great point. So the other day I asked Steve, what course of events turned you from a regular square to a badass ninja? How does one become a private investigator? Much to my glee, the ACP House Dick answered the call.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of your friendly neighborhood Trunk Monkey. So, let's dive in, shall we? Well, a lot of people over the years and recently have asked me, Trunk Monkey, how did you go about from being your average everyday Joe Schmo to such a ninja? Well, I'd have to back up to about 2002, give or take. I had just graduated from a Big Ten college with a degree in criminal justice. I started as pre-med, much to the delight of my mother, and I finished as a bit of a goon. I made the mistake, of course, in my infinite college age's wisdom, to not go to a law enforcement academy. Now, most of the other colleges in Michigan offered some sort of police academy that would get you certified by the time of graduation. Mine, however, did not. And had I even planned a little bit better, I probably could have gone straight to an academy out of high school and be looking at about my 20th year on the local sheriff's department, with an impending retirement as I near the age of 40. Now, neither of those specific things happened, so there I was, debt-free, a recent college graduate, and moderately employed. I had done some work as a bouncer in college. I had run an internship with the state police, which I believe I've mentioned in prior stories. I also worked security as a goon, parking enforcement, and the like while going to school, and I just basically kept at it, filling my resume with a bunch of filler jobs. Now, I think I put my resume out on the internet on, one of the original sites, maybe Monster or something like that, and I just kind of threw it out there after graduation, and I thought nothing of it, really. I had hoped maybe I could land a gig doing something related to law enforcement. I believe I interviewed with the Border Patrol, the FBI, made it through the first and second round. I do remember taking a couple polygraph tests. Those are fun. Now, I thought even about military service because I did do 2 years in ROTC in college immediately before September 11th. However, due to the cancer diagnosis and a reconstructed knee, that was two strikes, and so those sort of plans just never happened. Now, it was around about October of 2002, after being out of college for about 5 months, that I got a random call from a number that I didn't recognize, so I answered. They said, "Hey, we saw your resume, and we'd love to train you as an investigator if you pass our interview process." I said, "Well, okay, I'll apply, and we'll see what happens." So I did. I went through a series of probably three or four different phone interviews, and then after that, it got quiet for a couple weeks. I don't remember how long it was, and then I got a phone call saying, "We want to bring you on board." I said, "Sweet," and they said, "We're going to fly you to corporate, put you up in a hotel for a week as we train you to do the job and, you know, learn our protocols and this, that, and the other, yada, yada." So I fly down to corporate. And we make formal introductions, and we dive into a week's worth of training. Ride-alongs, policy discussions, legal discussions, and how you do things. Of course, there's nothing like experience. So it was certainly a learning process, and I screwed up a lot, because there's a lot of things that civilians, of course, cannot do that law enforcement can do that I was aware of, and vice versa. Now, I certainly thought this beat sitting in a cubicle somewhere. I got the gig, and it was essentially me being a remote employee, and they sent me home with a pile of gear, a camera, video cassettes, and these were the large oversized camcorders still at that point, high-8 VHS. And then, of course, as time went on, it progressed to mini DVDs and such. I mean, they even sent me home with a fax machine. That was mailed. I didn't take it on the plane with me. And all manner of stuff to basically outfit a home office. Now, my first stint with this particular company lasted about 3 years, and the pay was really good for a single, unattached college graduate. I bought a motorcycle and paid for it with cash. I even bought my first house. I was with this particular company, all told, for about a decade in two different stints. And looking back, I really don't regret it. I made some really good friends there who I still talk shop with on a regular basis. I mean, we talk, at least every couple weeks, and we get together for beers maybe once or twice a month. And we go over and back and forth with ninja stories and, generally compare notes. Then I moved to another company, another nationwide company, and I worked there for a while. And I don't regret my time with them either. It's all been a rather remarkable learning process. And, national companies work different than regional companies. And, policies vary. And the work culture varies between a lot of the big guys. Now, the downside with working with larger employers is that I focus on fraud specifically. That's my bread and butter. But for some nebulous and unexplained reason, it would always drop off as if the sales team just took a vacation, starting at about Thanksgiving and lasting till around New Year's. By 2012, 2013, I got tired of the potential of starving during the winter lean months. So I said, screw it. And I secured my own license. And this was right about the time of my come to Jesus moments, which you guys are familiar with if you're regular listeners to my segment. And that was with regards to firearms. So it was a really big perspective and professional shift about 2012, 2013. And I haven't looked back ever since. I run my own shop. I've got more than enough work, and the projects keep me busy for the foreseeable future. Now, I do love field work, because every day is a different adventure. Right now, I'm recording this from the town of Hamtramck. And I prefer handling stuff myself, because if I want it done right, I will go out and do it myself. I've built my own team of monkey ninjas, and I'm relying on them more and more, which allows me to sit back some and ponder other ventures. Personally, though, guys, I'd advise most people against getting into this line of work. It's a lot of long, weird hours. It's been trying on my personal relationships, and some professional, because, you know, I have to keep business and personal separate for safety reasons. I've run vehicles out from under me until they quit, and early on it wasn't all that great for my health, and I'm still undoing that particular damage. 75 pounds is a lot of weight over 15 years. All that being said, guys, I really wouldn't change it for the world. Hopefully, this might clear up any and all nagging questions you folks may have come up with while wondering how this monkey got stuck in the trunk to begin with. But, that's about it. That is the origin story for the trunk monkey. So, as always, guys, be safe, be smart, and stay ninja.
So if you're like me, you were surprised to hear that the trunk monkey once had cancer. So I asked him for the details, and this is what he told me. Back in the year 99 or 2000, he had stage 2A Hodgkin's nodular lymphoma centered around the lymph nodes of his neck. When he received chemotherapy, the drug protocol he was on became the standard mode of treatment about 2 years later. He considers himself cured because he's 20 years out and a chance of recurrence is less than 1%. So that's good news all around.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. And I was wondering, because I'm like, oh, this was pretty, he must have been pretty young when that happened. So I didn't know. I actually know a bunch of guys that all had like testicular cancer in their like late teens. So that was another thing. I didn't quite want to ask him if he still had both his balls.
Well, I am incredibly nosy and have very few boundaries, so if you're my friend, I will just come up and ask you stuff.
Yeah, no, it's a fair question.
And I think I started off the IM conversation with cancer. I had no idea you had cancer.
Yeah, and if he's sharing it on a podcast, you're not crossing any lines.
Yeah, but he was on chemotherapy for I don't know how many years, and he said it sucked.
Yeah, that's the chemotherapy thing. I know there's a bunch of people who are talking about like targeted gene drugs and things like that to stop the cancer. There's a lot of people out there that are like, I really want chemotherapy to be one of those barbaric medical treatments that people read about in textbooks and go, oh my God, we actually did that to people?
Yeah. Well, that is what it is. It works. That's the only thing we've got that works. But yeah, it's brutal right up there with a lot of the Civil War field procedures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the surgical procedures. Well, here, bite this stick and we're going to do an amputation. Ugh.
Yeah, or as the husband of an epileptic, epilepsy medicine is just a sedative. And actually, much of the anticonvulsant drugs also have a similar use for antipsychotics. So if you've got a psychosis, by taking anticonvulsants, it will keep the voices at a dull roar.
So correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be mistaken, but wasn't a lobotomy an early treatment for epilepsy?
It might have been. Most of the lobotomies that I'm aware of were for psychotics, were for violent psychotics. And essentially, you're just carving their personality out and essentially turning them to semi-vegetative. It was a really, really brutal procedure, but also not as barbaric as you might think because there were no drug alternatives. So these people literally needed to be locked up in rubber rooms. So 6 to 1, half a dozen to another.
Okay, I just thought I heard that it was a treatment for you know, the really, really bad, you know, like the grand mal seizures.
Well, so you want to go very, very ancient. That was where they would actually drill holes in the people's skulls to try to let the demons out.
Oh, trepanning.
Yes. I'm glad you knew. I was about to look up the term. but yeah, that was the... I actually said to my wife's neurosurgeon when he was talking about opening up her skull and what method he was going to be using to do that, I said, so is this the point where the evil spirit comes out? And he did not appreciate the humor at all.
Oh, yeah, but trepanation is ancient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you seen those pictures of the skulls that are just completely Swiss cheese?
Yeah.
Yeah, where they were just like one of those, oh, the demon didn't come out there. Let's drill a few more.
Yeah, but I mean, when I mean ancient, I mean, last I heard, they were doing trepanation like in prehistory.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I know the skulls that I've seen that are Swiss cheese, some of them were pretty old. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the new ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can read more from me at Lurking Rhythmically, Blue Collar Prepping, BlazingSword.org, and PinkPistols.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
I've got a bottle in front of me, and he's got a frontal lobotomy. Our styles are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.